and welcome to the Triathlon Coach Podcast. My name's Simon Ward and I'm your host for this weekly show where my goal is to share practical, usable advice from the best athletes, coaches and experts from the world of triathlon so that you can get the most from your training time and maximise your enjoyment of the triathlon lifestyle. If you don't already know me, I'm the founder of thetriathloncoach.com and the SWAT Inner Circle, and I've been a triathlon coach for over 20 years, working with absolute beginners right up to Olympic athletes and coaching them to race at distances from sprint through to Ironman. Reviews and ratings are the currency of podcasts, so if you enjoy today's conversation, I'd really appreciate it if you could drop into iTunes, Podbean or Stitcher and leave a rating and a review. And while you're there, please subscribe to our weekly episodes so that they can be downloaded straight into your phone or your iPad or wherever you choose to listen to them. And finally, to say thank you, I have a free gift for you. I've put together 25 of my top tips amassed from 30 years of racing and training and coaching in the sport. All you have to do is email triathlonsuccess to beth@thetriathloncoach.com and she'll send it right out to you. Okay, now it's time to crack on with today's guest. And today's guest is the CEO of Ironman himself, Mr. Andrew Messick. Welcome to the show, Andrew.
Very happy to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
It's a pleasure, absolute pleasure. And I know you've got a busy schedule, so I'm really pleased you could find time to come and chat with us. The last time I saw you, you were in Kona enjoying a little bit of post-race celebration there with your team. But you had some challenges ahead of you then. I remember you telling us about the big challenges you had with Ironman Florida. How did that all work out in the end?
Well, I think Ironman Florida turned out to be a very positive experience for our athletes and in fact for our company. You know, we were put in a position where we had to change the venue from Panama City Beach, where we've been for the last 19 years, to a new venue because of the devastation from Hurricane Michael, which completely, you largely wiped out the Panama City Beach community. And so we were able to, in less than 4 weeks, I mean, we made the decision really just after the Ikoma Mai banquet in Kona that we needed to move Ironman Florida and we needed to find a new venue. And so from there, I think we had a little more than 3 weeks to be able to make that happen.
Wow. And I mean, you know, being in Panama City for so long, you would know the infrastructure, the people, the volunteers, everything. You pretty much started from scratch there, aren't you? Which is starting from scratch with a year's notice is challenging. Starting from scratch with 3 weeks' notice must have, well, I know that you say anything's possible. So clearly it was, but.
Well, it was, I mean, it was a big challenge. You know, Haines City is a place where we've had 7 years of experience operating a 70.3, but a 70.3 and a full are very different. And so we needed a course, we needed permits, we needed police support, we needed medical, we needed volunteers, we needed everything. And so, you know, pulling all of that together was really, it was a yeoman's effort by a lot of people and our partners in Haines City stepped up in a huge way. And our athletes were, I think, remarkably good spirited. You know, none of us wanted to just fall back on saying, you know, we had a force majeure event due to a hurricane and, you know, there's going to be no Ironman Florida. And I'm sorry that you trained for a year, but, you know, it's, you know, acts of God are what they are. And so we turned ourselves inside out to get our athletes a race and we raced 2000 athletes. We had about 700 of them transferred to Ironman Texas for 2019, but the overwhelming majority, you know, came and raced and they had, we set a world record in the swim that we've never had an Ironman swim that had more turns than the swim in Lake Eva. You had to go around 12 buoys over the course of the two laps in the lake. And, you know, everyone handled it and they handled it well. We had a good two loop bike and then we had a pretty wiggly run course. That had some neighborhoods and some mountain backs and a few different things, but we were able to get a full race for our athletes. And that's really what we wanted to do. And I think that it was a really good day for Ironman. And I'm not just talking about for a company, but for our athletes and for the community. We had a ton of volunteers come out. We had, you know, people, you know, the clubs all came out, everybody volunteered. And I think we did right by our athletes, and it was a proud moment for us.
So given the devastation at Panama City and the way in which Haines City sort of rose to the task, is it your plan to go back there next year then and give Panama City a bit more breathing space to rebuild, or will you be going back there to support that location?
No, we've been in close contact with Panama City, and they've told us that they're going to be not only ready for Ironman Florida in 2019, which will be the 21st year of Ironman Florida, but the 20th year in Panama City Beach. But in fact, they will be ready for the 70.3 Gulf Coast, which is a May race, and that they are looking forward to welcoming, you know, Ironman and our athletes and their family and our community, to Panama City Beach in May. And so we're excited about that. Our foundation rebuilding and community support effort will be attached to the 70.3 Gulf Coast. And so we'll be bringing a big contingent up in May, you know, to work in the community and to really give back. We've raised a lot of money, more than $100,000, you know, through the foundation, and that'll be used to provide grants to help the community get back on their feet. And, you know, and it's a community we've known for a long time and that we care about a lot. So it'll be good to be back there, and it'll be good to see them, you know, back on their feet.
I'm interested to, you know, what you're saying there about, the fact that you're obviously aware of the athletes have trained all year, that they want to do a race, that you didn't consider not putting a race on for them and tried to find that. We had a similar problem for Ironman UK last year, where an act of God, you know, well, maybe it wasn't an act of God, but anyway, whatever it was there was a fire on the moor that was right in the area where the road was going through the original route, and the emergency services asked for that route to be closed. It was dangerous, so they hastily had to find a different route, which meant that the bike course for the race was 95 miles. And I know a lot of people there felt shortchanged. They felt that, you know, they were being denied the opportunity to do a proper Ironman because it wasn't the full 140.6 miles. They felt that the Ironman Corporation didn't care about them, and they just wanted to put on the race, and you know, who's bothered about whether these athletes get to finish a race or not. But from what you're saying, that's not the case at all.
No, I think our first responsibility always is to create a safe race for our athletes. And there's always opportunities to, you know, to do things that aren't safe and that don't have the support of public safety and don't have the support of the community. And we're highly reluctant to do that. And we're always going to choose to create if we have to shorten a course, we always will for safety reasons. You know, we'll shorten a swim, we'll shorten a bike, we'll shorten a run. And we've done all of those things over the years. And our belief is it's never worth it to risk somebody's safety just to get them six more miles on the bike course and to put people in a position where they're going to be in a, you know, a dangerous situation with regard to automobiles. We're just not going to do it. And, and we understand that people want 112 mile bike course, and they want 26.2 for the run, and they want 2.4 miles for the swim. And sometimes it is impossible. And we're never going to take a chance. We're just not going to do it, because imagine if something happened and we decided to have a 2.4 mile swim on a lake, and there was fog, and fog means you can't see all the athletes, right? You lose visual line of sight to your athletes. And we have foggy swims all the time, and we always shorten the course. And if you don't, what happens if someone gets in trouble and no one can see them? You know what?
And so
we're pretty humorless around safety. And while we're sensitive to how much our athletes want to complete the full distance, we have an obligation to not unnecessarily risk their safety. And we take that seriously, and we hope people understand that it's not worth it. It's not worth it to do something dangerous that puts people at an unnecessary risk. And it's also the other corollary to this is this is something that we hear a lot is the 32-year-old super fit athlete says, what do you mean we can't swim today because there's 2 meters of surf? I could do that. Well, you know, the woman's in the woman's 60, 64 age group, maybe she's in a different point of view on that. And so the race course has to be safe for everybody, not just, you know, people who are young and strong. We have a whole range of athletes who are competing. Some are experienced, some are less experienced, and some are more and less prepared. And we're going to establish a single criteria for whether we think something is safe. And that criteria may be frustrating to people who are super strong and super skilled and, you know, often young. And there is no alternative to that. And it's frustrating to people at times, but, you know, we have no alternative.
I guess, I mean, you know, Iron Man has grown massively. I did my first one in 1995, and I think that was Penticton in Canada, and there was probably only 7 or 8 to choose from at that stage. Yeah. I mean, you probably lost count because you're putting on so many of exactly how many Ironman and 70.3 events you have. But
41 Ironman, and we'll have 116 70.3s in 2019.
Okay, so that brings me on to a whole load of other questions. I mean, you've almost been a victim of your own success in that the races are hugely popular. There are big numbers in some of them. Some would argue too many if we look at some of the drafting issues that were sort of widely publicized last year. I suppose my first question then would be, what's your criteria for choosing a venue for a new event? Because I remember when I started, it seemed like the towns where they had them in Penticton, in Taupo, Lake Placid, in Lanzarote were small towns where the Ironman meant a big deal. There were no big city locations. So I know there are a few. Is that changed now?
Well, before I get to that, I want to stop you on two things.
Okay.
You said we're a victim of our own success. There's not a single day ever that I wake up thinking that I'm a victim. And in our organization, we don't think we're victims. Let's be super clear about that. You know, we are proud to be in the business of delivering life-changing events for extraordinary people. That's what we do for a living. And, you know, and I think we do a pretty good job of it. And we are lucky to be able to earn our living doing what we do. So that's the first thing. The second thing, coming back to drafting, I would say that, you know, there's some very specific issues around the world championship that I'm happy to talk about that are unique to that race. And because they're unique to that race, you need to talk about them in isolation, because I think that, you know, the situation we have in Kona is unique and is remarkable. And, you know, it creates a whole series of operational challenges that are unlike any others, and so, you know, that I think is a separate chapter. But going back to your broader question, you know, we've got successful races in all types of environments, and so you have Lake Placid and you have. You have Taupo and you've got Klagenfurt, you know, which are small town races, you know, a lot of history deeply embedded in those communities. And those are fantastic races, but you've also got Ironman France in Nice, which is not a small town race. And you've got Ironman Frankfurt, which is not a small town race. And you have Copenhagen, which is not a small town race. And those races are unique and distinctive in their own way also. And I think athletes like having a choice. They like having a choice between wetsuit and non-wetsuit swims. They like having a choice between flat versus hilly bikes. They like having a choice between resorts like Whistler and communities that are more urban and sort of conventionally vibrant. And we try to provide a mix. But what it comes down to always is, does the community want us? Can we create a race course for our athletes that we think is going to be at our standard? And part of that is athlete experience, and part of it is, you know, fundamentals around, you know, swim, bike, run, and safety. And we know what we're looking for. But, you know, just given the vagaries of the topography and the, you know, of the world, you know, you're never going to get one specific thing. You know, you've got multi-loop swims and bikes and runs, and, you know, we fit the specific characteristics of every community to the best of our ability. And I think we do a pretty good job of that. We provide a lot of choice for our athletes.
You started a race that was in Edinburgh in Scotland a couple of years ago, which seemed to be very popular, but I see that one's now been discontinued. So what is that an issue then with the local authority, or do you find that the course doesn't work, or is there something else?
Well, you know, we are highly diligent in accumulating and assessing feedback from everybody that we are in business with. You know, if you race with us, you know that you get an athlete survey on the Wednesday after every race. It's the same survey for every Ironman and 70.3 in the world. So we have 160 plus data points about what constitutes best practices for our race. And we ask about a lot of detailed questions about swim, bike, run, aid stations, transition, venues, all of that. And we have to make assessments about if we were able to deliver the type of race and the athlete experience that we're trying to deliver at a certain venue. And if we can't get it right, and we don't get it right, and our athletes aren't happy, and we conclude that the things that are making them unhappy are not fixable, then we are unafraid to make the difficult decision and not go back. And it happens. And when you have a portfolio of 160 races around the world, every year there's going to be a couple that fall into that category, which are, for whatever reason, the community's changed, the courses changed, there's been construction, there's been some natural weather event that has required a reconfiguration of swim, bike, run, transition, aid stations, all manners of things. There's times when we say we just can't do it in this community anymore, at the standard our customers expect. And we would rather make the difficult decision to say, you know, we're not going back to Edinburgh than put a race that we know is substandard, because then our athletes are going to know it too. And then you're just prolonging your own agony, and you're wasting the time of your customers. And we're not inclined to do that.
Okay. Well, you touched on Kona then. So can we go back to that and talk about that specifically? Because I had a few questions, and one that always comes up, particularly from people that race there, is this issue of, I don't know, is it congestion? I know that you've got the World Championships. The time period between 1 hour and 1 hour 15 seems to be, you know, the middle of the bell curve. There's a huge amount of people coming out of the water at the same time. Yeah. Then you've got that sort of 10 miles around town, which is quite technical, and a couple of no overtaking zones. Do you think Kona's has reached its capacity in terms of age group athletes there?
Well,
there can't be much more space on the pier to start with. I know you've been doing your best, but that must be a challenge in itself.
Well, there's overwhelming demand to race Kona. That's the first thing, is that, you know, Kona is the race everybody wants to do, and it's incredibly hard to get there. And the caliber of athlete is extraordinarily high. I will give you one fun fact from last year's race. We had 505 age group male athletes arrive in T2 in less than 6 hours. So that's a 60-minute swim, 5 minutes of transition, and riding 455, 500 of them. And so that is an extraordinary concentration of outrageously fast guys. And I think that that's the headline for Kona, is that, and these aren't pros, these are age groupers. And the headline is, how do you handle, it's not so much 2,500 athletes, it's this extraordinary concentration of people who are smoking fast. And what do you, how do you manage that? You know, we have, you know, we had up until a few years ago, you know, we had one gun start for all age groupers. We split that to a men's wave and a women's wave. And that was largely designed to decrease peak density. And density on the bike course is a function of density coming out of transition one, which is a function of swim exit, which is a function of how you put people in the water. And so we're looking at a whole series of options for 2019 about how do we flow people into the water differently? Because I think, I think we're concerned about the density issues as well. I think our technical staff believe that it is a density issue. It's not a drafting issue, and that the overwhelming, and that the overwhelming majority of people are trying to ride clean. And, and people who, and by the way, people who ride 450 are accustomed to being all by themselves. You know, these are people who qualified by being miles off the front in one of the 40 qualifying races around the world. There tend not to be packs of people who swim 60 minutes and ride less than 5 hours at a typical Ironman race around the world. Those guys tend to be all by themselves with tons of real estate in front of them and in back of them because they're so fast. But density is an issue. There's no doubt about it. And it's due to the success I think that we have in attracting the very best athletes in the world to qualify and to race. And so we recognize that, you know, we need to do something about it because, you know, having that many people coming out of the water, it's crazy. If you're, you know, if you're at swim exit, the number of people who are swimming incredibly fast and then tearing through transition and getting on the bike, it's remarkable. And so we need to do something to spread that out. And we're not at a position to announce what we intend to do, but I can tell you we are going to do something for 2019, and the specific, you know, the specific intention of, and goal of that will be to decrease bike course density, and we've got some ideas.
I guess it's difficult there because the narrow entrance into the beach there, and then the nature of the start is different from a lot of other races as well, isn't it?
So yeah,
you don't have quite as many options in Kona.
We don't, but we have some. And we've got a clever and creative team, and we think that there's some things that we can do to de-bottleneck some of the constraints that we have operationally, and we're gonna take a really hard look at them in the next couple of months to try to flow the athletes into the water a little bit more slowly, and that has the potential to, you know, take a lot of pressure off. And the last thing I'll say about Kona this year, you know, because there was no wind, the average bike split for age groupers was 21 minutes faster than it was in 2017. That's a lot. So the fact that there's almost no wind really did make a difference, but I think it just highlights what we needed to do anyways. So this was a good, it was a good kick in the butt for us.
You'd never, would you ever consider doing what you've done with the 70.3 Worlds and having the men and women racing on different days?
Well, you know, it's something that we talk about all the time. We think our operational team on the ground think that getting 2 days of permits, 2 days of volunteers, 2 days of medical support, 2 days of community support for us shutting down the west side of the Big Island of Hawaii is at this point not feasible. Yeah. If we could get 2 days, we would, but our guys on the ground there say, just at this point in time, forget about it. It's not going to happen.
Yeah, I guess you've got the things like the airport to take into consideration as well, haven't you, there? And people getting in and out of the island that aren't involved with the Ironman.
Yeah, and it's a very difficult, if you've been out there and you've seen the race.
Yeah.
Queen Kaʻahumanu is the main artery, you know, in West Hawaii. And we shut it down. We pretty much shut it down completely. We shut it down completely all day long. And the community is prepared to tolerate that, you know, one Saturday a year. And we've been told in no uncertain terms, they are not prepared to support it two Saturdays or two days a year, especially if it was Saturday and Sunday. So that one is unfortunately is not on the table for us, because that would solve just a ton of problems.
Yeah, but just, I know there's always conversations about Kona being the world championships and that you should perhaps move it around. Would that be something that would ever be on the cards given the iconic nature of it?
Well, I can tell you, if it's going to happen, it's going to happen when someone else is the CEO. I have no intention of being the guy that moved the world championship from Kona.
Okay. I've got a line drawn for that question. So perhaps that'll be a good point to move on.
I'll let the next guy think about that one.
Okay. So while we're just on extraordinary competition then and the performances, there's been growing talk over the years about doping, not just in the pro ranks, but within age groups. And I know you've tried to do something about this. What steps can you take and what steps do you take, given that this is probably something that's a WTC initiative rather than the WAD, I think, I would guess.
No, but I mean, we are, you know, World Triathlon Corporation, we are WADA signatories. We're the only private company that is a signatory to the World Anti-Doping Code. We have our own internal anti-doping initiative. We spend well in excess of $1 million a year on anti-doping. You know, the woman who manages our anti-doping program, you know, used to work for USADA. You know, we have a fantastic partnership with not only USADA, but, you know, many of the major NATOs around the world. We have our own independent anti-doping program for both professionals and age groupers, that is completely code compliant. We test people every year. We catch people every year. And I don't think there's any organization in the sport of triathlon, with the possible exception of the ITU, that does more to promote and support clean sport than us. But, you know, it's, you know, anti-doping is like having a police department. You know, you have to have a police department. You want to be a good police department, but I'm not sure you're ever going to eliminate crime, no matter how hard you try. And so, you know, I think the way we handle anti-doping, both at an age group level and a elite level, is sound. You know, we're thoughtful, we're strategic. We rely on a ton of inbound information from people in the community about abnormal and unusual performances. You know, we have a right, once an athlete is registered for an event, to test them in competition or out of competition, and we do. And so, you know, I think we, in a lot of ways, we are really utilizing best practices in trying to create both a deterrent for people using prohibited substances and methods, and catching people in the act. But you're never, you know, this is like policing. You know, I'm not sure it's realistic to think there's ever going to be a time when, you know, you're free of crime and you don't need the police department anymore.
While we're on Kona, there's one thing that again comes up regularly, and it's about celebrities who do your race. What goes into your decision making in order to allow celebrities to race in Kona?
Well, part of what we want to do is we want to tell a story to the world that captures the imagination of athletes and lets us really showcase the value of you know our sport and our lifestyle and to be able to capture a larger audience, to be able to to get inspired to compete and to race. And celebrities, whether it's Gordon Ramsay or whether it's, you know, we've had professional athletes, we've had Springboks, we've had NFL players, we've had all kinds of, we've had speed skaters, compete in recent years. And all of it is we're trying to create a bigger megaphone to the world around, you know, the extraordinary benefits and, you know, the extraordinary, you know, the extraordinary race that is Ironman. And in the larger scheme of things, we're not talking about very many people. And, you know, Kona continues to be a race in which, you know, more than 95% of people qualify. And in terms of, you know, celebrity in media athletes, you know, it's a small number. It's, you know, 20 out of 2,500. It's less than 1%.
Gordon Ramsay's participation, I think, is probably the one that sparks the angst amongst British triathletes in that they don't see why he gets a place. You know, somebody more deserving could have got it. I know Gordon Ramsay through another athlete that I work with, so I've met him a couple of times, and I know that he was quite hurt by some of the adverse publicity he got in the UK for his participation. But I also know that he loves endurance sports. He's done plenty of marathons. He loves his triathlon, and as you say, his appearance on the start line at Kona generated a lot of publicity in publications where Ironman probably wouldn't normally get mentioned. So in terms of that, it was good for the sport. It was good for you. It was good for Gordon Ramsay as well, because he had a great time doing the race. But I just think perhaps maybe it's not communicated, or maybe other people aren't picking up the message about the reason why the celebrities are there or what they're doing. And if Gordon Ramsay wasn't there, then I guess somebody else would have been offered his place. It wouldn't have gone to an athlete qualifying, would it? You're not actually taking a place from somebody who could come across and get a slot.
No, I mean there's always a handful of slots that are used for non super speedy athletes. You know, we had 170 legacy athletes race.
Well, I was one of those last year, Andrew, and I do thank you for that, because I would be one of those non-speedy triathletes who perhaps would never have got a chance to compete in Kona through the normal qualification methods. But my loyalty to the brand for 20 years was recognised in that way, and I'm grateful for that opportunity. And I know that everybody else who gets the chance to take a legacy slot is also grateful. It gives some sort of hope.
But don't forget, you know, the same person who was, you know, 13th in the men's 40-44 at, you know, Ironman Lake Placid and is saying, you know, Gordon Ramsay has taken my slot. You know, that person's also saying, why is, you know, fat and slow old Simon Ward on the start line?
You know, because, hey, come on.
But you've got, you know, there's always, everybody wants to go to Kona. Everybody wants to race Kona. And so everybody scrutinizes every person that isn't going faster than 9:30 saying, why are they there? And why shouldn't that be me? And, you know, and it's one of the mixed blessings of Ironman is, you know, it's frustrating, but at the same time, you've got people who are passionate and committed and engaged, and you don't ever want to lose that. And so, you know, I think we try to tell people is, you know, the Ironman World Championship it's a world championship, but it's also more than a world championship. It's, It's the home of triathlon. It's the birthplace of our sport. And there's going to be other people racing, and there's going to be other people racing for other reasons. And part of that is to talk about our sport and to promote our sport and to inspire more people in different places around the world. And we need to have some people racing to be able to do that. And so, you know, we're always going to have a lot of mouths to feed, and well, that's just part of it.
If you go back to Valerie Silk's tenure as, you know, leading Ironman, she wanted the lottery as it was then to help maintain the tapestry of the sport, the colorful mm-hmm. characters that perhaps wouldn't be at the front end, going under 10 hours, but to do exactly what you said there, you know, give some mm-hmm. other human interest. And I think that's what the legacy does currently, and those other initiatives you have. Okay, look, we've got a few minutes left, Andrew. I know you've got other engagements, so I've got a few more less challenging questions for you.
Okay.
Talk about getting to Kona. Have you ever done an Ironman? Have you ever finished one?
I finished four.
Oh, you finished four. Okay.
I did Ironman Lake Placid last July for the 20th.
Fantastic.
My second time.
Do you have the tattoo?
No. I don't have any tattoos. Yeah.
What do you think about that whole tattoo movement of the M dot and the various incarnations and artwork that goes around it?
I'm proud that people care enough about our brand and about what we've created at Ironman to put it on their bodies. And it's a very heavy responsibility for us. And when I see an athlete with an M dot tattoo, It makes me and everyone else in our company feel even more responsibility to be a good steward of Ironman and to create great race experiences for them and to make our brand and our races worthy of the commitment and sacrifice of these extraordinary athletes all around the world. So, you know, proud and scared, you know, every race we try to get exactly right, and we're always terrified we won't. But we try hard, that's for sure.
In days gone by, you'd hear stories of whether how much substance there was to them, of tattoo artists in Kona being told that they weren't allowed to do these M dot tattoos because it was infringing a copyright. But from what you're saying there,
that's baloney.
Yeah,
that's hogwash.
So
it's a good story though.
Yeah. Well, perhaps in the days before you arrived at the helm, how many races do you get to go to each year? And do you try to get outside of the US, or does it make it difficult with your day to day responsibilities?
No, I travel all over the world and go to races all over the world, and whenever I can, I try to race. So, you know, I've done our races in the Philippines, in Korea, in Vietnam, in Austria. You know, I race every chance I can get, which isn't that much, but part of, you know, I think it's important that I be an athlete and that I compete. And it's something I take seriously. I do our mountain biking events. I do our running events. I do our triathlons, and I try to bring the real spirit of, you know, an age group athlete to the company and making, making sure that we're delivering what we should be delivering in the way we do. And I was an age group athlete long before I was in this job. I mean, I did my first Ironman in 2005 in Penticton. And so I've done Penticton. I've done Placid twice. I've done Mont Tremblant, and I've done 20 70.3s in, I don't know, more than 10 countries, but it's the best way to really test, you know, are we delivering? You know, you go out there and you suffer with everybody else. That's how you really get a sense of the extent to which our teams are delivering the Ironman experience to our customers.
Have you ever done any races put on by Challenge or any of the other race promoters and events out there?
I have done cycling and mountain biking events, and obviously a ton of running events from other producers, but I've never done any of the Challenge races. I'd like to do Roth sometime. I've heard it's fantastic.
Yeah, well, yeah, me too. I think after Kona, it's on everyone's bucket list. Is it like asking you what's your favorite child if I ask you what's your favorite non-Kona Ironman race?
I really don't want to answer that because I'm convinced I'll get it wrong. I think all of our races, you know, have some distinct character, and that's something we work really, really hard to promote. I want every race to be deeply loved by the teams that put it on. And I want them thinking, you know, about how do you create great athlete experiences? How do you capture the imagination of athletes? I want the teams staring at the ceiling at 4 a.m. like I do, thinking about how do I make, you know, Honu 70.3 or Zelim say 70.3 or Staffordshire as good as we possibly can make it. And I think by and large, we do a really good job of that. And I don't want to disrespect anybody by saying, I think there's one race that I hold above all others.
Okay. That's a fair point. I've got a couple more questions for you. One serious, okay. A couple of little. So, okay. Talking of athlete experience, a couple of my friends had situations this year where they weren't able to race. One was had qualified for Kona, broke her foot about a month before when her horse trod on it and wasn't able to race. And the other one, his father died about a month before doing a race, doing the Ironman in Barcelona, and then they had the funeral and all the family, you know, bereavement stuff after that. But because he'd missed the cutoff to that, he wasn't able to defer his entry, and he wasn't able to get much of a refund. Do you just have a blanket policy as far as those sort of incidents go, or do local race directors have flexibility to take each case on its own merit?
Well, I would say first and foremost, we have in recent years made enormous changes and enhancements to, you know, to our athletes around what they can and can't do. You know, we've introduced transfer policies. We've introduced deferral policies. We've, you know, there's lots and lots of opportunities for our athletes who, if life gets in the way for whatever reason, for them to be able to continue or extend their Ironman journey somewhere else or at the same race some other time. You know, but you have to have some rules. Or if you don't have rules, then everything becomes a one-off negotiation and it stops being fair. And then the determination of, you know, who gets, you know, into another race, who gets a deferral becomes a function of, you know, the ability to, for someone to tell their story or the best negotiator. And so, We have rules like we do at the races, and we expect people to follow them, and people agree to follow them when they sign up for our events. And so we're always prepared to make an exception for the exceptional circumstance. But it really has to be an exceptional circumstance, because I think our belief is we have a fair agreement between the athlete and the company. And we've provided people lots of alternatives. And so, you know, there's always going to be somebody who is frustrated because they get the flu the week before the race, or they get in a bike accident a week before the race. And our teams do the best they can to be fair when there are truly exceptional circumstances.
Okay. Right. Ask but one question. We talk about you going to the races. You obviously get a chance to watch, and I've seen you at the finish line every time I've been to Kona, waiting there for the last finishers to come across the line. It's quite an emotional moment. I mean, some of those people coming across, they've, as you know, they've overcome some enormous physical challenges just to get to the start line, and them and others have undergone some enormous physical and mental challenges to reach the finish line. Do you ever find yourself getting emotional, or are you able to remain detached from all of that?
Well, I'll tell you, if you don't love that part of the race, you're doing the wrong thing for a living. And I love the races. I love competing in them. I love going to them. I love helping our athletes succeed. And that is the most satisfying part of the job for me. And it's my good fortune that I know a lot of athletes, and I am relatively deep into the triathlon community, and I know what an awful lot of people have gone through and have to go through in order to get to the finish line. And, you know, our athletes are extraordinary people, and many of them have overcome extraordinary things. And the optimism that I get from seeing people determined to reach a goal and then finding a way to do it is massively inspiring to me. And I think it's massively inspiring to everybody else who works at this company, because, you know, an Ironman's never easy, but for some people and under some set of circumstances, it's harder than others. And to see, especially at the finish line in the last hour, you know, people who've been out there so long and have had so many extraordinarily good opportunities to quit, and yet they keep finding reasons not to quit. If that doesn't inspire you, man, boy. You know, I don't know what does.
Well, it inspires me, mate. I'm there and volunteering to catch those people and helping them through to pass the medical tent and to go and get their medal and their t-shirt and get a massage. And you know, it's what helps me stay awake from 5 a.m. until midnight. Really,
yeah, it's a long day. Huh?
You know, it is. It is a long day. And you know, I had five athletes this year, and waiting for every one of those, I caught every one of them across the line. I walked them around. It was emotional for each of those people and for me catching them there. But, you know, the joy on their face when they stand on top of that little ramp underneath the timing gantry, and Mike Riley's calling out their name and they're doing their little bow to the crowd. It's emotional, I think, for you, for me, for them, for the crowd. And Riley does a great job of whipping up that emotion, doesn't he?
Yes, he does.
Just before we finish, then listen, I'm resurrecting a fun a little bit, and I thought you'd be good to start off with this one. So I've got some quick fire questions for you.
Uh-oh.
It's an either or choice. Okay.
Okay.
You ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. So pizza or burgers?
Pizza.
Beatles or the Stones?
Beatles.
Ah, you're not going to go to the Stones gigs that are coming to the US in next year. Coke or Pepsi?
Coke. Flat, but only in the second lap of an Ironman run.
I wrote this one, and then I looked at your resume, and I think I probably know the answer. NFL, NBA, or NHL?
Oh, that's a tough one. You know, I have a deep loyalty to the NBA because of all the years I spent there. But Tampa has one of the best hockey teams in the country, and my 11-year-old son is a crazy hockey player. So I'm going to call that a tie between the NBA and the NHL.
Okay. Porsche or Ferrari?
Porsche.
Wonder Woman or Daisy Duke?
Oh, Wonder Woman, because she has superpowers.
Apple juice or Fireball?
Apple juice. And I think I know where that one came from.
Absolutely. I just threw that one at the last minute. Excellent. Excellent. We'll keep that one as our little secret. Listen, Andrew Messick, CEO of Ironman, it's been fantastic to have you on the show. Thanks so much for sparing some time.
I appreciate it. Thanks, Simon, for being a part of the community. And it was good seeing you in Kona. And look forward to seeing you at the races later this year.
Certainly. And listeners, thank you once again for being here to listen. We'll come back next week with some more great guests, as good as today's. But for now, this was Andrew Messick. I'm Simon Ward, and this was the Triathlon Coach Swapcast. Enjoy the rest of your week. That's a wrap for this week's episode. Thank you so much for listening to the conversation, and I hope you learned at least one thing. If this is the first time you've listened in, please go back and take a listen to some of our previous guests, and I can guarantee they will be just as good as the one you've just heard. If you've been a regular listener, then thank you for being a part of this journey with me so far. Finally, I'd like to take just a few seconds to tell you about my SWAT Inner Circle program. In the last few years, I spent an awful lot of time creating training programs and resources to help you train and race at whatever triathlon distance you choose, and for some of the events outside of triathlon like aquabike, duathlon and swim run events. As a SWAT member, you get access to all of these plans for 12 months of the year, and on top of that we provide guidance on strength and conditioning, nutrition
plus a whole host of other supportive activities which help you to train, recover and race better. We also have a really friendly Facebook community. It's an exclusive Facebook page for SWAT members only, and there are over 150 of them already. If you join, you'll be able to get access to that page, and you'll be able to ask for help, and our members are all too happy to provide guidance and advice based on their experiences. I'll also be there to help you find solutions to your training problems, and all you have to do is tag me in the Facebook page in one of your posts, or you can book a 15-minute phone call should you need one. If you'd like more information, or if you're ready to press the button and join the SWAT Inner Circle, just email beth@thetriathloncoach.com and she will send you all of the details. So that's all for this week. Hopefully I'll see you again next week, same time, same place, with a different guest.